the three people that have been removed have decades of expertise, and to let them go, it was just kind of breathtaking.
Governor Walker shakes up the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation Board. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, January 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Senator Murkowski pushes the Keystone XL pipeline.
My goal, and I know the goal of the Republicans, is to advance this through the process as quickly as possible.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2015 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
It wasn't quite a midnight purge. At 9 p.m. last evening, Governor Bill Walker announced via press release that half the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation Board of Directors was being dismissed. And in the process, he put the oil and gas industry on notice that he would be doing things differently from his predecessor. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez has more.
The announcement came just 36 hours before the board tasked with representing Alaska's interest on a natural gas megaproject was set to get an update on how the work was going. Of the five public members, three, Drew Pierce, Al Balea, and Richard Rabinow, were notified they should not plan on attending the meeting. Walker says his reason for removing these members was not personal. He says he mainly wants to see more geographic diversity on the board and plans to make sure rural areas are represented.
I think we need to spread out a bit.
All three were appointed when the board was created in 2013 by former Governor Sean Parnell. Pierce is involved with oil spill response work, and she previously served as the federal coordinator for an Alaska natural gas project and as president of the Alaska State Senate. Balea is a retired BP executive who once chaired the Alyeska Pipeline Services Company board. Rabinow is a former president of the ExxonMobil Pipeline Company. Rabinow's appointment was opposed by a bloc of Democrats because of his status as a Texas resident, and legislation explicitly permitting out-of-state board appointments was passed to allow him to serve. The original announcement did not provide a reason for the dismissals, except for to say the changes were part of a paradigm shift in the way the state will conduct business with Alaska's gas. In addition to the board dismissals, Walker announced that the two cabinet members, Labor Commissioner Heidi Dreigas and Acting Commerce Commissioner Fred Parody, who represent the administration on the board, have been directed not to participate in discussions that require confidentiality agreements.
There's certainly appropriate time to go into executive session, and the organization do that all the time, but it's unusual to then on top of that layer on top of that a confidentiality agreement. It just seems like it's one more step of keeping the public away from what's going on, and I'm not sure. I'm just not convinced that's the way to do business.
The state is currently in talks with Exxon, BP, ConocoPhillips, and TransCanada to develop an 800-mile pipeline to get North Slope natural gas to market. The project is expected to cost at least $45 billion. In 2014, the legislature passed and Parnell signed a bill that would allow legislators to review specific terms of negotiations so long as they sign non-disclosure agreements. The producers involved say the confidentiality rules are needed to prevent competitors from learning proprietary information about the project. Walker is allowing his Natural Resources Deputy Commissioner, Marty Rutherford, to participate in confidential meetings.
We will participate in the AKLNG, our representative, and we will have, that's a completely different entity and different process.
Walker's announcement was met with a mix of surprise and apprehension by key Republicans in the state legislature.
The three people that have been removed, of course, have decades of expertise and experience, and to let them go, it was just kind of breathtaking.
Anchorage Republican Kathy Giesel is the chair of the Senate Resources Committee. She's worried that rehauling the board puts the Alaska LNG megaproject at risk.
I'm concerned it's going to slow it down. as we miss windows of achievement on that timeline, this could jeopardize the project altogether.
Giesel is also concerned that refusing the confidentiality terms could make it hard to work with the partners on a project.
You know, to reject that means we're rejecting a seat at the table. It doesn't make sense.
Without confidentiality agreements, I just can't see this project going forward.
House Speaker Mike Chenault agrees with Giesel on that point. The Nikiski Republican thinks delays in the project are possible, depending on how much time new appointees need to get up to speed. But he says they're not inevitable. Mostly, he's left wondering how big a break Walker plans to make with the Parnell administration's approach.
Nobody was informed on what was transpiring. And, by sending out that message, I have no clue which direction the governor wants to go. Mm-hmm. Is he wanting to keep these two projects online, or is he wanting to kill these or come up with some other project? I don't know.
The remaining members of the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation Board of Directors are scheduled to meet on Thursday in Anchorage. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Governor Walker scheduled meetings with two of President Obama's cabinet secretaries while he was in Washington yesterday for the swearing-in of Alaska's new U.S. senator. He says he talked to Interior Secretary Sally Jewell about the road options to the Greater Moose's Tooth Field on the North Slope. That wasn't the only road they discussed. Walker says Jewell seems resolute in opposing a road between King Cove and Cold Bay, but he says it was good to hear her exact reasons. Walker says he doesn't think it's a lost cause.
Well, I'm not convinced of that. sometimes a fresh set of eyes on it is a good thing, and so I'm going to take a look and see what there are some options available and in advancing that road project.
He took up the Prince Rupert Ferry Dock with Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox. Walker made the case for a waiver from the requirement to use U.S. steel. It was the new governor's second trip to the nation's capital since he was sworn in. He says he doesn't plan to make the trip so frequently in the future. The new congressional session is barely underway, but Senate Democrats managed to derail Senator Lisa Murkowski's plan for this morning. She'd hoped to hold a hearing on the Keystone XL pipeline in the Senate Energy Committee. APRN's Liz Ruskin explains why that didn't happen and what Murkowski plans next.
The Keystone Pipeline is the signature environmental fight of the moment. It's the rallying cry, the poster child, the new polar bear. It occupies the political space once held by the fight over drilling in Anwar. The new Republican leadership of the Senate made it their number one priority. Senator Murkowski is eager to move the bill through the Energy and Natural Resources Committee. She's the committee's incoming chairman. But Democrats threw up a procedural hurdle on the Senate's opening day, objecting to the hearing she'd planned. Murkowski says she's undeterred.
My goal, and I know the goal of the Republicans, is to advance this through the process as quickly as possible.
President Obama has already issued a veto warning. Here's his spokesman, Josh Earnest.
I would not anticipate that the president will sign this piece of legislation. We promised, we indicated that the president would veto similar legislation that was being considered by the previous Congress, and our position on this hasn't changed.
The White House followed up with an official statement saying the Keystone bill would cut short an important permitting process. It galls Murkowski.
Cut short were the words that the president used. This has been under consideration for 6 years. Give me a break.
She and other Republicans say the pipeline will create jobs and has broad support among the public. The pipeline is intended to move oil from Alberta through Nebraska and ultimately to refineries in Texas. Opponents say it will contribute to global warming, especially because it will carry petroleum extracted from the oil sands of Alberta, which environmentalists say is particularly harmful. Murkowski said last month she intends to use her committee chairmanship to get things done by passing bills the president will sign, not just to send a message. Now, even with a veto threat looming, she says Keystone is worth fighting for. Murkowski says Senate Republicans can't let President Obama set the agenda.
I don't think we're going to sit back and just wait to see what the president wants to support before we decide we're going to move forward with it.
She's proceeding with another committee meeting on the bill this week. She says she'll work to get a veto-proof majority on the bill, but she acknowledges that may not be possible. Nose counters around the Senate say it's about 4 votes short of that 67-vote threshold. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, scientists capture a generations-long polar bear migration.
Instead of sort of random movements of bears across the Arctic, we found a directional movement towards the Canadian archipelago.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Enroll now in the health insurance marketplace. Sign up at healthcare.gov. Open enrollment ends February 15th. Depending on your income, age, and family size, you may be eligible for discounts that may lower your monthly cost and out-of-pocket expenses. Pick a plan that is right for you and your family. Call 211 for free individual assistance about the health insurance marketplace. Visit getcoveredalaska.org for more information. This message sponsored by ASHNA, a partner of Get Covered Alaska.
A new study released yesterday by the U.S. Geological Survey suggests polar bears are in the midst of a generations-long migration to areas that still have year-round sea ice. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Lily Peacock is a research wildlife biologist for USGS and the lead author of the study. She says, historically, polar bears are highly nomadic and move unpredictably. But over the last few generations, the bears' movement patterns have been changing.
Instead of sort of random movements of bears across the Arctic that we found in sort of the more ancient historical picture, we found a directional movement towards the Canadian archipelago.
The Canadian archipelago is home to one of 4 clusters of genetically similar polar bear populations. During the study, Peacock's team analyzed nearly 3,000 genetic samples of bears ranging from Alaska's North Slope to the Russian Arctic to Canada's Hudson Bay, dating as far back as 1972 and as recently as 2011. Peacock says this suggests polar bears are subtly shifting north.
Our hypothesis is that they're doing so because of changes in their habitat, especially because it's been hypothesized and modeled that that's where ice is going to be persistent, and it's likely that the ice might become better habitat in the Canadian archipelago. It's considered poorer habitat right now, but the multi-year ice there might become annual ice and become more productive.
Peacock says this shift isn't a product of bears marching en masse from northern Russia all the way to northern Canada. It's more of a genetic migration made over the course of several generations.
That means an individual home range shifting northward, that animal mating with another animal that might be at the southern part of her range, but then that offspring might go to the northern part of her grandmother's range and, you know, mate with someone else. So sort of this, like, shift of genes northward.
But, according to Peacock, declining sea ice could put a damper on the process and potentially threaten worldwide populations by cutting off the bear's migration routes.
And what can happen when populations of animals become isolated is that they're more easy to, they can blink out if something happens. You know, if they have a bad winter or a bad spring, then, and that stresses the population and they get smaller and smaller, but the migration corridor has been cut off and you can't repopulate.
Though scientific modeling can't predict exactly what the future holds for polar bears, Peacock says the results of the study say the Canadian archipelago may become a very important habitat for polar bears over the next several generations. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Areas of Fairbanks and North Pole are suffering poor air quality this week as cold, stagnant air allows smoke from wood burning and other combustion to accumulate. The situation is nothing new and is the focus of state and local plans to clean up the air. Fine particulate pollution is a known health hazard, and as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, that's confirmed in a locally produced report.
Fine particulate pollution is causing 50 to 101 premature heart and lung illness-related deaths every year in the Fairbanks North Pole area. That's the conclusion of retired Fairbanks pulmonologist Dr. Owen Hanley in a report released last month. North Pole consistently registers poor air quality during the winter, with downtown Fairbanks often not far behind. Dr. Hanley says the mortality estimate is calculated by plugging local pollution and population data into an established formula for estimating fine particulate pollution health impacts.
If you use North Pole numbers, you get higher. If you use Fairbanks numbers, you get lower.
Hanley says an Alaska Department of Health doctor came up with the same mortality figures, but adds that the estimates do not account for the potential of additional deaths due to suspected more severe consequences of breathing fine particulates derived from wood burning.
Wood smoke is particularly bad because it has, on the particle, there's a lot of very irritating substances, a lot of aldehydes and other chemicals that are on those particles that when you inhale them, they're much more reactive to your vascular system than a particle that doesn't contain all of those inflammatory provokers.
Dr. Hanley says wood smoke pollution spikes like those experienced in recent days can also up the human health risk. He calls fine particulate pollution caused deaths completely preventable and considers the cost of providing a clean energy solution for the community low compared to what's spent combating other more complex health threats. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Work continues on the Juneau Access Project despite Governor Bill Walker's spending freeze, Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Juneau Access Road is one of six projects Walker put on hold during his first month in office. It would extend the capital city's highway system about 50 miles to the north to a new ferry terminal on Lynn Canal. From there, shuttle ships would complete the link to Haines and Skagway. In his announcement, Walker told state agencies they could complete what's already paid or contracted for, but he said no additional money could be committed or spent. Juneau Access Project Manager Gary Hogan says the Department of Transportation's current work is preparing an environmental review needed for federal funding and approval.
We just finished going through the public involvement process. And what we do next is review the comments, respond to comments, and evaluate and select the final alternative.
Hogan says that will take about a year and $600,000. He says no other work is planned for now.
We would have expected to go into design and construction, but that's been put on hold.
Governor Walker has made a very smart decision to put the brakes on the Juneau Road extension.
Emily Ferry works for the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. SEAC says the Alaska Marine Highway System offers a safer, more environmentally friendly alternative.
DOT's own study shows the extraordinary cost of constructing and maintaining the road far exceeds the minimal benefits of making weekend getaways a little bit cheaper for Juneauites.
The agency says the road would do a lot more than that. It also says the project would ultimately save money by shortening ferry routes. Walker's decision did not make road supporters happy, but they say they're not giving up.
You know, disappointed in it. I don't know that that's the end of the project. I think it's a bump, and probably for all those other projects, too. I think, you know, they'll probably all come back at some point in time.
Wayne Jensen chairs the Alaska Committee's Board of Directors. He supports building the road to increase access to the capital city. He remains optimistic.
The stuff that's committed is continuing, and I think that's a good sign. They've got contracts committed and processes in play, and I expect those will continue until some point in time as either there's a further delay or projects are reinstated.
Walker said low oil prices mean the state cannot afford the road and the other five projects right now. The state faces an approximately $3 billion budget gap for the current fiscal year and the same amount for the next one. Other projects put on hold are the Ambler Road, the Susitna-Watonna Dam, the Kodiak Launch Complex, the Nick Arm Crossing, and the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. If you are a rural Alaskan knowledgeable about fish and wildlife resources in your region, please consider applying for one of the 35 seats on your Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Councils. Council meetings serve as a forum for regional public involvement in federal subsistence management. Apply by January 23, 2015. Information at 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
The Environmental Protection Agency and Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation are working to clean up a month-old diesel spill northeast of Valdez. The spill occurred December 9th at mile 48 of the Richardson Highway. Icy conditions caused a tanker truck operated by Alaska Petroleum Distributing Incorporated to slide off the road, spilling 4,400 gallons of low-sulfur diesel into a currently dry roadside creek bed. Spill response began immediately, but the company had to cease its cleanup efforts just before Christmas, citing a lack of resources. EPA and Alaska DEC crews resumed the work yesterday. Steve Russell is an environmental program manager with the Alaska DEC. He says cleanup efforts are going well so far, but below zero temperatures are slowing things down.
20 below, things don't move quite as quick as they do if it's 30 above. But we anticipate that the cleanup effort will continue and will be successful.
Alaska Petroleum Distributing Incorporated removed about 650 cubic yards, or about 25 semi-truck trailers full, of contaminated dirt. DEC anticipates the removal of about another 350 cubic yards. Russell says the DEC doesn't anticipate any impact to fish, but will continue to monitor the site over the next several months. Kelly Pagina is the new interim executive director of Juneau's Front Street Community Health Center. He's also the program manager of Catholic Community Services Hospice and Home Care of Juneau. As he juggles two jobs, Pagina hopes to help the homeless clinic get through some growing pains. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
33-year-old Kelly Pagina says he doesn't have much of a social life these days. He says his dual leadership positions have similar responsibilities.
In regards to some of the things that I've experienced at Hospice and Home Care at Juneau with implementing more of the administrative business backbone to the program, kind of saw a relationship here at the Front Street Community Health Center and in regards to recruitment, the staffing, the billing platforms to be implemented and put into place.
Pagina is the second executive director of Front Street Community Health Center since last May when it left umbrella organization Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium. Pagina says the clinic, which has offered medical, dental, and behavioral health services, is going through a challenging transition.
We're still in the works of really trying to pick up the pieces of having the luxury of a large organization provide your billing, your payroll, your human resources. These are all things that we have to do at the clinic level now.
Pagina sat on the board of the health center prior to becoming its interim executive director. He has 3 months to fulfill some big goals. One is continuing to diversify its clientele. Front Street has long been a homeless clinic and still receives a large chunk of its federal funding for that purpose. It hopes to provide care for patients from all walks of life.
Because there is a need for thousands of people in our community. So my goal is to make it efficient and effective and available for people to access, whether it's the homeless population, uninsured, underserved, or someone that is conveniently located nearby.
At the end of March, the Front Street Community Health Center Board will reevaluate Pagina's position. Dr. Carlton Hine is a board member.
Does he have the capacity to do this job with his other job, or do we need to look for a different person for executive director?
Until then, Pagina says he's confident with the help of staff and community members, the health center will get through the tough transition and start offering patient-centered care to more of Juneau's population. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Anchorage turns 100 this year, and one of the city's first permanent homes was the Oscar Anderson House downtown. KSKA's Ann Hillman toured the historic mansion-turned-museum.
Oscar Anderson claimed he was the 18th person to arrive at Anchorage's original tent city along the banks of Ship Creek in 1915. He soon started a butcher shop. Unlike others who saw Alaska as a short-term adventure, House Museum tour guide Mary Flaherty says Anderson decided to make the new settlement his home.
He was a little bit older. He was about 33 when he came. As a businessman, I think he saw the potential.
During the city's first land auction in July of 1915, Anderson bought a plot on Cook Inlet near what's now M Street and 4th Avenue.
When Oscar first bought in this part of town, it really wasn't that popular to live on the water. It was a long ways from 4th and 5th Avenue where the business activity was. You had to hike the hill, certainly in the winter.
And the plot, like all of the others in town, didn't offer much.
Tree stumps and dirt. And a new place to put your tent.
A few months after buying the area, Anderson's wife and three young children joined him. They stayed in a tent from October to December while they constructed one of the first wooden-framed houses in Anchorage. The style and layout of the brown and yellow house matched many others around the United States, but not in Alaska.
For here, it was pretty much a mansion. Most people, if they built it all, one-room log cabin.
Part of the challenge was getting the supplies to Anchorage.
It just was hard to build. It was expensive to get all those supplies and that, since we don't have local material that can be put to use right away.
The Anderson home features a small floral wallpapered parlor with a short, elegant couch. A massive iron stove dominates the kitchen and abuts a small dining room complete with a china cabinet. The bathroom's original flush toilet was fed by an upstairs water tank. A narrow staircase leads to the second floor.
It gets kind of cozy up here, but still, better than a one-room tent.
Barely 2 feet from the top step is a full-sized bed. Anderson and his wife slept in the hallway across from the only closet in the house. The children shared tiny bedrooms on each side. Flaherty says Anderson was a prosperous Swedish entrepreneur. During his years in Anchorage, he dabbled in raising cattle, mining coal, starting an airline, and serving on the board of a newspaper. His tiny mansion lent an air of sophistication to the frontier town with its player piano and gramophone.
And the family, or at least Oscar, liked opera.
The Andersons were the only owners of the house. They donated it to the municipality in 1976. It had to be picked up and moved 60 feet across the street because the original land was sold for building condos. Then, after 4 years of restoration work by volunteers, it opened as a museum in 1982. It's filled with memorabilia of many of Anchorage's first non-native settlers. Ice skates hang in the Arctic entry, Old Spice boxes line the kitchen shelves, and photos of high school basketball teams hang on the parlor walls. Flaherty says the house isn't just significant because of the owners. It represents the beginning of the city and the families that chose to make it their homes. Tours of the house are available all summer. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld and Lisa Fu in Juneau, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Subsistence is important to many rural Alaskans. Please consider applying for a 3-year term on your Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. Councils provide information and recommendations to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. Apply by January 23, 2015. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Alaska Pacific University now offers the APU Promise Tuition Grant, a program designed to significantly minimize or eliminate out-of-pocket tuition expenses for Pell-eligible students. More at 1-800-272-7528. This message is sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.